Today I am delighted to introduce to you a friend and colleague, Jerome Sapolsky, who is formerly of Virginia Tech and now has begun this semester, well, officially has begun this semester, but next semester will begin teaching there at Goucher College in Maryland as assistant professor of religious studies, and will be leading the Judaic Studies program there as well. Jerome has master's and undergraduate degrees from Columbia and Wesleyan universities, respectively, I believe, and a PhD from the University of Chicago. And he, during the times of the shootings at Virginia Tech, he was an assistant professor of religion there. And he's also the author of an important article in the Journal of the American Academy of Religion relating to the topic of civil religion that we're discussing today, entitled, we think, Pledge of Allegiance and the Meaning and Limits of Civil Religion. We'll have that up on our website, a link to his page in the next couple of days if you'd like to check that out. We're delighted to have you here, Jerome. His title for his talk today is A 33rd Stone, Civil Religion, Mourning, and Memorials at Virginia Tech. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Eric. I'm happy to be back here at Bozzi Center. I was lucky enough to be able to spend the summer NEH seminar here with Eric and with Professor Wolf, so I'm really delighted to come back and be in this room and to be able to speak to all of you about this particular issue, which is about what happened in the aftermath of the shootings at Virginia Tech this past spring, but I also think has ramifications for the way in which we think about civil religion and religion in a broader context as well. I guess the reason why I was asked to speak on this topic was first because I was on the Virginia Tech faculty from 2007 through this past summer, and I was an observer of the events that transpired in April, being a faculty and community member. And also that one of my primary areas of scholarly research is on this issue or problem of civil religion. And I guess to begin, I want to speak a little bit about what I mean when I use the term civil religion, how I've used it in some of my work, and how I'm going to sort of use it when talking about what happened in the aftermath of the shootings of April 16th. My colleague Grace Gow and I at Virginia Tech wrote an article on Pledge of Allegiance and the Meaning and Limits of Civil Religion. And there we use the term to refer to a symbolic system that binds members of a political community to one another through the use of shared historical narratives, through myths, rituals, usually pinned to some notion of transcendence, whether it's God or the people or the nation or the overarching values of the nation, say liberty, democracy, what have you. And if we regard this functionally, civil religion can provide sacred legitimation of the social order. It sort of underwrites the social order by integrating the members of the society, mobilizing them, and endorsing important social and political institutions and authorities. So that was basically what we used as our starting point to talk about civil religion. And the prime example that we used in that paper was the Pledge of Allegiance, where it's obvious that this is a ritual that's being used on a very frequent basis to inculcate certain ideas and certain values and a certain sense of community. We could also talk about parades and rituals of mourning and celebration under this rubric of civil religion. Now, one of the things that the paper was about was to discuss the relationship between, the relationship and tension between this notion of an American civil religion and, if I may call it, real religions. The religions that people participate in their churches or their synagogues and their mosques. And that there's often some overlap, but often some tension between the claims of civil religion on the one hand and those of one's preferred religious organization on the other. And I think we're going to see some of these tensions in my discussion of how the symbols of mourning and memorials were brought to bear in the wake of 416. So quickly, let me briefly outline my remarks. I want to talk about two events. The first is the convocation that was held the day after the shooting, on the afternoon of April 17th, and which included remarks by the governor of Virginia, Tim Kaine, President George W. Bush, representatives of campus religious communities, and the acclaimed poet Nikki Giovanni, who's also on the faculty of Virginia Tech. And then I want to turn to the memorial that was established to its victims, and the way in which the memorial was constructed and its placement on the university campus. And in doing so, I want to consider how the official language and symbols of mourning and remembrance emerged, as well as the tension between these symbols and language of mourning and the religious claims of others from both within the Virginia Tech community and from without that community. So first, the convocation of April 17th. It was a huge event that was held in the basketball stadium. And the overflow crowd was brought to the football stadium and also other places on campus, which was able to show it on television. Many, if not most, of the students who were in attendance turned out in school colors, wearing official school t-shirts in maroon and orange, or at least wearing those colors. And as I said, the convocation featured speeches from political leaders, the governor of Virginia and the president. Tim Kaine, who is known to use or talk about his religion, his Catholicism, quite forthrightly, in his remarks appealed to the story of Job in the Hebrew Bible and to Jesus' cry on the cross as examples of sort of struggling with disaster, of struggling with suffering. The president actually, in his speech, he mentioned the faith communities in a sense more directly. There, Bush, and I'm quoting from Bush's speech, said, "These sources of strength are also in the faith that sustains so many of us. Across the town of Blacksburg and in the towns all across America, houses of worship from every faith have opened their doors and lifted you up in prayer. People who have never met you are praying for you. They're praying for your friends who have fallen and who are injured. There's a power in these prayers, real power. In times like this, we can find comfort in the grace and guidance of a loving God. As the scriptures tell us, don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." So again, sort of presenting his remarks in an explicitly religious fashion here, talking about the power of prayer and the experience of a loving God and the guidance of that God, and a brief quote from scripture to overcome evil with good. These speeches by Governor Tim Kaine and President Bush were followed by remarks from Muslim, Buddhist, Jewish, and Christian campus religious leaders. And they were notable for their use of expansive and relatively inclusive religious rhetoric. These speeches spoke of trust in the divine plan, included calls to love and compassion, saw the events as an opportunity for the community to come together, to recognize itself, to do good, and to illuminate the values of the religious community. There was an appeal to the particular sources of those traditions, the Quran, statements by the Dalai Lama, quotes from Ecclesiastes. But despite such quotations, the remarks were generally inclusive and non-sectarian. They were a rhetoric which was, I think, sensitive to and appropriate for a situation in which the victims were from diverse religious backgrounds, and that even though the Christianity is the overwhelmingly the majority religion in Virginia Tech, there was an attempt to find an inclusive and generally non-sectarian language to discuss the events and to discuss the way that mourners should experience and think about and go on in the wake of these events. In fact, there was some criticism, particularly of the Lutheran pastor, Reverend Bill King, for not being Christian enough. His remarks did not mention Christ and did not quote from the Bible, although it was clear to anyone who knows the Christian tradition that his words were deeply embedded in those theological streams. But there was some criticism, and actually, if you're interested, you can go and see websites where Reverend King was criticized for not using this opportunity to speak the gospel, to preach the gospel. So that was, I think, the way in which religion was brought to bear in a civil fashion at the convocation. But it was not, I think, the most powerful way in which civil religion was represented at the convocation. And to see that, I think we need to look at the speech that Niccolò Giovanni gave at the which came at the very end of the convocation, which I have a brief clip from here. And I think this will illuminate the way in which the Virginia Tech community found its language to understand or to go forward from these events. And so if you allow me, I want to play a brief clip from the convocation.
We are Virginia Tech. We are sad today, and we will be sad for quite a while. We are not moving on. We are embracing our mourning. We are Virginia Tech. We are strong enough to stand tall, tearlessly. We are brave enough to bend a cry, and sad enough to know we must laugh again. We are Virginia Tech. We do not understand this tragedy. We know we did nothing to deserve it, but neither does a child in Africa dying of AIDS, neither do the invisible children walking the night away to avoid being captured by a rogue army, neither does the baby elephant watching this community be devastated for ivory, neither does the Mexican child looking for fresh water, neither does the Appalachian infant killed in the middle of the night in his crib in the home his father built with his own hands, being run over by a boulder because the land was destabilized. No one deserves a tragedy. We are Virginia Tech. The Hokie Nation embraces our own and reaches out with open heart and hands to those who offer their hearts and minds. We are strong and brave and innocent and unafraid. We are better than we think and not quite what we want to be. We are alive to the imagination and the possibility. We will continue to invent the future through our blood and tears, through all the sadness. We are the Hokies. We will prevail. We will prevail. We will prevail. We are Virginia Tech.
I was asked by a friend of mine who was down, who's a reporter down from CBS Radio News covering the event, what had just occurred at the end of this convocation. And so I'd like to highlight the distinctive change in tone that Niccolò Giovanni's speech ushered in, which at its climax resembled nothing short of a pep rally speech. And the audience responded in a very spirited fashion. It seemed to me what happened at the end of the convocation, through Niccolò Giovanni's speech and through the audience reaction to it, was that the community reverted to its common language. That the common language of Virginia Tech is the language of collegiate athletics. That this is the language, and these are the rituals that this community shares. In this sense, the response was obvious, and in a sense normal, that it was a turn to the default collective languages and rituals of the university. And this was the language of group cohesion and group understanding. It was fascinating to watch this. I actually, in one of my classes in religious studies, one of the essay questions that I offer is in what ways is the Virginia Tech football game like a religious event? And they come back and they describe the uniforms, the colors that people wear, the rituals with the chants, which are like prayers or incantations. And it was clear that that's what was going on at the convocation itself. That there was a turn to the language that everyone could communicate in that room. And the catharsis that emerged at the end of this ceremony, which was a catharsis which I think is notable for not only for its almost martial quality. We are Virginia Tech, we will prevail. Prevail meaning to gain ascendancy through strength or superiority. It's not clear what was going to be prevailed over in the wake of the shootings of 416. But the statement was so powerful that it was taken up by the administration itself as the official language of the event. And it was language, it was a phrase that was used in official correspondence from administrators to faculty and students and other people in the community. It was a language which was used on the Virginia Tech website. People started wearing t-shirts saying, "We are Virginia Tech, we will prevail." Stores in the community used this in posters on their windows. And in fact, this language was integrated into the permanent memorial itself, which we'll see. I'd also like to briefly highlight another moment which, again, illuminates the tension between the official shape of the convocation ceremony and the religious positions of some of its participants. After the remarks by the campus ministers, there was a time where the Virginia Tech band played a version of Amazing Grace. And it was a very quiet and very beautiful performance. At the end of which, someone in the audience, not someone on the stage, not an official person on the stage in an official capacity, shouted out, "And now let us pray in the words that Jesus our Savior taught us." And people began to recite the Lord's Prayer. So everyone in that room, or not everyone, most people, stood up to recite the Lord's Prayer. And it was very clear that, from my vantage point at least, that this was a non-official sort of intrusion into the way the event had been planned. That from this non-sectarian balance of mourning and religious remarks, this very sectarian moment of prayer was brought in. And keep in mind that Virginia Tech is a state institution. It's not a private institution. That even with this intrusion, it was remarkable to watch how it took over the room. That most people in the room stood up and recited the Lord's Prayer in the middle. And many observers probably did not notice that this was not part of the official order of events. So again, what I call real religion sort of broke in and intruded upon the shape of this official civic religious ceremony. Now let me turn briefly to the memorials, the memorial that went up that week. Following the incident, a student group set up an impromptu memorial on the drill field, which is the geographic center of campus. And that memorial was made up of 32 stones from sort of local Hokie stones, one for each of the victims. And also on the drill field that day, in the days following the shooting, there were boards for people to write their remarks. There were places where people brought Bibles and flowers, religious tracts, cards. There were a number of religious groups that were both on-campus religious groups and religious groups that came to campus to use this as an opportunity to provide support or proselytize. So the whole drill field became, in a sense, a site of religious engagement and mourning. The impromptu memorial that was set up on the drill field became the space and the shape of the official memorial, which was dedicated at the end of August. And again, it was placed on the drill field in the geographic and, one might say, the spiritual center of campus in a space in front of the administration building. The memorial is marked by 32 markers, 32 of these Hokie stone markers arranged in a semicircle, and they're made of, each inscribed with the name of one of the victims. So they're little headstones arranged in a semicircle on the drill field. I think I have a photo here. I think you just
did that. Alt tab. Oops.
of order.
I'll let you look for it. So 32 markers arranged in a semicircle, each one inscribed with the name of one of the victims, made of the local Hopi stone. And then you could actually, this is the improv memorial in the days after April 16th, and you can see the flowers and the gifts that were brought to bear to mark each of these stones. In the center was a center stone, and it was inscribed with the words, "We will prevail, we are Virginia Tech." So we have a memorial in the center of campus in front of the administration building with a stone with each marked with the name of one of the victims in the center, the statement, "We will prevail, we are Virginia Tech." And this is clearly the official statement of memory, that the way the university wants to preserve the memory of the event, and it's integrated very strongly into the landscape and its placement, its use of materials, and its shape. And those who come by are sort of pressed with the obligation to remember and to consider oneself as part of the community in a particular way. Right? It's giving a very normative statement about what Virginia Tech is and what they will do. And in this sense, the monument does, to a certain extent, the memory work for its viewers. It draws the viewer into a particular vision of the university, creating a sense of a common memory, a common community, and a shared destiny. And in this sense, the tragedy can be integrated into the university's claim of community and purpose. Now, this memorial itself was, this vision of a common memory, a common community, was itself decentered by the placement of a 33rd stone by a Virginia Tech senior, Caitlin Johnson. And Caitlin Johnson, we're now talking about the impromptu memorial before the official memorial was unveiled. She believed that there were 33 victims of the shooting, that Sung Yu Cho, the perpetrator himself, needed to be remembered and recalled by the Virginia Tech community. So she took it upon herself one in the middle of the night, and the first anonymously, to bring a 33rd stone and to place it among the other 32 stones. And this became very, very controversial. At first, the stone that was brought was taken away, then someone brought a new stone. And the question was, what is the place of Sung Yu Cho in the way in which the event is remembered? There were some who said that he was part of the community, even if he was alienated from and destructive of the community, and the community needs to recognize that. There were others who said that the community needs to forgive, and as a means of forgiveness, to provide some kind of memorial or some kind of recognition of him. There were those who said that this was completely crazy and horrific, and that Virginia Tech students have lost their moral bearings. You could actually find this controversy both in the letters pages to the Roanoke Times and also in the blogosphere, where many commentators got into the act and, you know, asking about, was this an act of great spiritual maturity of Virginia Tech students, or was this an act of the fact that they've lost their moral center? In any event, this memorial, this 33rd stone was brought in, taken away, brought back, and kind of continued for a while, but it was not included or integrated into the official memorial. So the official memorial that was unveiled by the university only includes 32 stones. So that's what I wanted to discuss today. I wanted to talk about the ways in which the community itself found a language of memorialization and of the mourning, the way that language used certain mostly Christian religious aspects and tropes, but in which the large part was shaped by the pre-existing athletic language of the Virginia Tech community. There's one more thing that I want to briefly mention. Perhaps we can discuss it in the time that we have afterwards. He sent a package of materials to NBC News that NBC decided to show parts of, but not should make public parts of, but not all of. And in that self-presentation, Cho put himself forward as a martyr, as a religious figure, as someone who had been crucified and marginalized by a decadent materialist community, and as someone who was engaging in these acts of violence to protect those who are weak and innocent and suffering like him. In other words, he presented himself as a religious martyr. The commentary that I've seen on this has been almost universally to ignore or refuse to take seriously this religious self-presentation of Cho, to see Cho as someone who's a madman, who is maybe deploying religious language, but not to take seriously where that religious language came from and how it in itself emerged from a religious matrix that in our society. There was an interesting article that was written by a colleague of mine, Matthew Gabriel, who teaches medieval and Renaissance studies at Virginia Tech, to address some of these issues. But I think that there are issues that still are pressing and still could warrant some engagement. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Jerome.